We have not coupled so fiercely since before our son was born. Bent over the kitchen table, something old is lit within me, and I remembered the way we had desired before. How we had left love streaked on all of the surfaces, how we had relished in my darkest spaces. I scream with ferocity, not caring if the neighbors hear, not caring if anyone looks through the window with its undrawn curtains and sees my husband buried in my mouth. I would go out on the lawn if he asked me, let him take me from behind in sight of the whole neighborhood. I could have met anyone at that party when I was 17. Stupid boys or prudish boys or violent boys. Religious boys who would have made me move to some distant country to convert its denizens or some such nonsense. I could have experienced untold numbers of sorrows or dissatisfactions. But as I straddle him on the floor, riding him and crying out, I know that I made the right choice. We fall asleep exhausted, sprawled naked in our bed. When I wake up, my husband is kissing the back of my neck, probing the ribbon with his tongue. My body rebels wildly, still throbbing with the memories of pleasure but bucking hard against betrayal. I say his name, and he does not respond. I say it again, and he holds me against him and continues. I wedge my elbows in his side, and when he loosens from me in surprise, I sit up and face him. He looks confused and hurt, like my son the day I shook the can of pennies. Resolve runs out of me. I touch the ribbon. I look at the face of my husband, the beginning and end of his desires all etched there. He is not a bad man. And that, I realize suddenly, is the root of my hurt. He is not a bad man at all. To describe him as evil or wicked or corrupted would do a deep disservice to him, and yet... Do you want to untie the ribbon? I ask him. After these many years, is that what you want of me? His face flashes gaily, and then greedily, and he runs his hand up my bare breast into my bow. Yes, he says, yes. I do not have to touch him to know that he grows at the thought. I close my eyes. I remember the boy of the party, the one who kissed me and broke me open by that lakeside, who did with me what I wanted, who gave me a son and helped him grow into a man himself. Then, I say, do what you want. With trembling fingers he takes one of the ends. The bow undoes, slowly, the long-bound ends crimped with habit. My husband groans, but I do not think he realizes it. He loops his finger through the final twist and pulls. The ribbon falls away. It floats down and curls on the bed, or so I imagine, because I cannot look down to follow its descent. My husband frowns, and then his face begins to open with some other expression, sorrow, or maybe preemptive loss. My hand flies up in front of me, an involuntary motion for balance or some other futility. And beyond it, his image is gone. I love you, I assure him, more than you can possibly know. No, he says, but I don't know to what he's responding. If you are reading this story out loud, you may be wondering if that place my ribbon protected was wet with blood and openings, or smooth and neutered like the nexus between the legs of a doll. I'm afraid I can't tell you, because I don't know. For these questions and others and their lack of resolution, I am sorry. My weight shifts, and with it gravity seizes me. My husband's face falls away, and then I see the ceiling and the wall behind me. As my lopped head tips backward off my neck and rolls off the bed, I feel as lonely as I have ever been. Inventory. One girl. We lay down next to each other on the musty rug in her basement. Her parents were upstairs. We told them we were watching Jurassic Park. I'm the dad and you're the mom, she said. I pulled up my shirt. She pulled up hers and we just stared at each other. My heart fluttered below my belly button. But I worried about Daddy Longlegs and her parents finding us. I still have never seen Jurassic Park. I suppose I never will, now. One boy, one girl. My friends. We drank stolen wine coolers in my room on the vast expanse of my bed. We laughed and talked and passed around the bottles. What I like about you, she said, is your reactions. You respond so funny to everything, like it's all intense. He nodded in agreement. She buried her face in my neck and said, like this, to my skin. I laughed. I was nervous, excited. I felt like a guitar and someone was twisting the tuning pegs and my strings were getting tighter. They batted their eyelashes against my skin and breathed into my ears. I moaned and writhed and hovered on the edge of coming for whole minutes, though no one was touching me there. Not even me. Two boys, one girl. One of them, my boyfriend. His parents were out of town, so we threw a party at his house. We drank lemonade mixed with vodka, and he encouraged me to make out with his friend's girlfriend. We kissed, tentatively, then stopped. The boys made out with each other, and we watched them for a long time, bored but too drunk to stand up. We fell asleep in the guest bedroom. When I woke up, my bladder was tight as a fist. I padded down into the foyer and saw someone had knocked a vodka lemonade onto the floor. I tried to clean it up. The mixture had stripped the marble finish bare. My boyfriend's mother found my underwear behind the bed weeks later and handed them to him laundered without a word. It's weird to me how much I miss that floral chemical smell of clean clothes. Now all I can think about is fabric softener. One man, slender, tall, so skinny I could see his pelvic bone, which I found strangely sexy. Gray eyes, wry smile. I had known him for almost a year, since the previous October when we met at a Halloween party. I didn't wear a costume. He was dressed as Barbarella. We drank in his apartment. He was nervous and gave me a massage. I was nervous, so I let him. He rubbed my back for a long time. He said, "My hands are getting tired." I said, "Oh," and turned toward him. He kissed me, his face rough with stubble. He smelled like yeast and the top notes of expensive cologne. He lay on top of me and we made out for a while. Everything inside of me twinged pleasurably. He asked if he could touch my breast, and I clamped his hand around it. I took off my shirt, and I felt like a drop of water was sliding up my spine. I realized this was happening. Really happening. We both undressed. He rolled the condom down and lumbered on top of me. It hurt worse than anything ever. He came, and I didn't. When he pulled out, the condom was covered in blood. He peeled it off and threw it away. Everything in me pounded. We slept on a too small bed. He insisted on driving me back to the dorms the next day. In my room, I took off my clothes and wrapped myself in a towel. I still smelled like him, like the two of us together. And I wanted more. I felt good, like an adult who has sex sometimes and a life. My roommate asked me how it was, hugged me. One man, a boyfriend, didn't like condoms, asked me if I was on birth control, pulled out anyway. A terrible mess. One woman, on and off, sort of girlfriend. Classmate from Organization of Computer Systems. Long brown hair down to her butt. She was softer than I expected. I wanted to go down on her, but she was too nervous. We made out, and she slipped her tongue into my mouth, and after she went home, I got off twice in the cool stillness of my apartment. 2 years later, we had sex on the gravel rooftop of my office building. 4 floors below our bodies, my code was compiling in front of an empty chair. After we were done, I looked up and noticed a man in a suit watching us from the window of the adjacent skyscraper, his hand shuffling around inside his slacks. One woman. Round glasses, red hair. Don't remember where I met her. We got high and fucked, and I accidentally fell asleep with my hand inside of her. We woke up at pre-dawn and walked across town to a 24-hour diner. It drizzled, and when we got there, our sandaled feet were numb from the chill. We ate pancakes. Our mugs ran dry. And when we looked for the waitress, she was watching the breaking news on the battered TV hanging from the ceiling. She chewed on her lip, and the pot of coffee tipped in her hand, dripping tiny brown dots onto the linoleum. We watched as the newscaster blinked away and was replaced with a list of symptoms of the virus blossoming a state away in Northern California. When he came back, he repeated that planes were grounded, the border of the state had been closed, and the virus appeared to be isolated. When the waitress walked over, she seemed distracted. "Do you have people there?" I asked, and she nodded, her eyes filling with tears. I felt terrible having asked her anything. One man. I met him at the bar around the corner from my house. We made out on my bed. He smelled like sour wine, though he'd been drinking vodka. We had sex, but he went soft halfway through. We kissed some more. He wanted to go down on me, but I didn't want him to. He got angry and left, slamming the screen door so hard my spice rack jumped from its nail and crashed to the floor. My dog lapped up the nutmeg, and I had to force-feed him salt to make him throw up. Revved from adrenaline, I made a list of animals I have had in my life. 7, including my 2 betta fish, who died within a week of each other when I was 9. And a list of the spices in pho. Cloves, cinnamon, star anise, coriander, ginger, cardamom pods. One man, 6 inches shorter than me. I explained that the website I worked for was losing business rapidly because no one wanted quirky photography tips during an epidemic, and I had been laid off that morning. He bought me dinner. We had sex in his car because he had roommates and I couldn't be in my house right then, and he slid his hand inside my bra. And his hands were perfect, fucking perfect, and we fell into the too tiny back seat. I came for the first time in 2 months. I called him the next day and left him a voicemail, telling him I'd had a good time and I'd like to see him again. But he never called me back. One man. Did some sort of hard labor for a living. I can't remember what exactly, and he had a tattoo of a boa constrictor on his back with a misspelled Latin phrase below it. He was strong and could pick me up and fuck me against a wall, and it was the most thrilling sensation I'd ever felt. We broke a few picture frames that way. He used his hands, and I dragged my fingernails down his back, and he asked me if I was going to come for him, and I said, "Yes, yes, I'm going to come for you. Yes, I will." One woman. Blonde hair, brash voice, friend of a friend. We married. I'm still not sure if I was with her because I wanted to be, or because I was afraid of what the world was catching all around us. Within a year, it soured. We screamed more than we had sex or even talked. One night we had a fight that left me in tears. Afterward, she asked me if I wanted to fuck, and undressed before I could answer. I wanted to push her out the window. We had sex, and I started crying. When it was over and she was showering, I packed up a suitcase and got in my car and drove. One man. 6 months later, in my post-divorce haze. I met him at the funeral for the last surviving member of his family. I was grieving, He was grieving. We had sex in the empty house that used to belong to his brother and his brother's wife and their children, all dead. We fucked in every room, including the hallway, where I couldn't bend my pelvis right on the hardwood floors, and I jerked him off in front of the bare linen closet. In the master bedroom, I caught my reflection in the vanity mirror as I rode him, and the lights were off, and our skin reflected silver from the moon. And when he came in me, he said, "Sorry. Sorry." He died a week later, by his own hand. I moved out of the city, north. One man. Gray eyes again. I hadn't seen him in so many years. He asked me how I was doing, and I told him some things and not others. I did not want to cry in front of the man to whom I gave my virginity. It seemed wrong somehow. He asked me how many I'd lost, and I said, "My mother, my roommate from college." I did not mention that I'd found my mother dead, nor the 3 days afterward I'd spent with anxious doctors checking my eyes for the early symptoms, nor how I'd managed to escape the quarantine zone. "When I met you," he said, "you were so fucking young." His body was familiar, but alien, too. He'd gotten better, and I'd gotten better. When he pulled out of me, I almost expected blood, but of course there was none. He had gotten more beautiful in those intervening years, more thoughtful. I surprised myself by crying over the bathroom sink. I ran the tap so he couldn't hear me. One woman, brunette, a former CDC employee. I met her at a community meeting where they taught us how to stockpile food and manage breakouts in our neighborhoods should the virus hop the firebreak. I had not slept with a woman since my wife, but as she lifted her shirt, I realized how much I'd been craving breasts, wetness, soft mouths. She wanted cock, and I obliged. Afterward, she traced the indents in my skin from the harness and confessed to me that no one was having any luck developing a vaccine. "But the fucking thing is only passing through physical contact," she said. "If people would just stay apart..." She grew silent. She curled up next to me and we drifted off. When I woke up, she was working herself over with the dildo, and I pretended I was still sleeping. One man. He made me dinner in my kitchen. There weren't a lot of vegetables left from my garden, but he did what he could. He tried to feed me with a spoon, but I took the handle from him. The food didn't taste too bad. The power went out for the fourth time that week, so we ate by candlelight. I resented the inadvertent romance. He touched my face when we fucked and said I was beautiful, and I jerked my head a little to dislodge his fingers. When he did it a second time, I put my hand around his chin and told him to shut up. He came immediately. I did not return his calls. When the notice came over the radio that the virus had somehow reached Nebraska, I realized I had to go east. And so I did. I left the garden, the plot where my dog was buried, the pine table where I'd anxiously made so many lists, trees that began with M. Maple, mimosa, mahogany, mulberry, magnolia, mountain ash, mangrove, myrtle. States that I had lived in. Iowa, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Virginia, New York. Leaving unreadable jumbles of letters imprinted in the soft wood. I took my savings and rented a cottage near the ocean. After a few months, the landlord, based in Kansas, stopped depositing my checks. Two women, refugees from the western states who drove and drove until their car broke down a mile from my cottage. They knocked on my door and stayed with me for 2 weeks while we tried to figure out how to get their vehicle up and running. We had wine one night and talked about the quarantine. The generator needed cranking, and one of them offered to do it. The other one sat down next to me and slid her hand up my leg. We ended up jerking off separately and kissing each other. The generator took, and the power came back on. The other woman returned, and we all slept in the same bed. I wanted them to stay, but they said they were heading up into Canada, where it was rumored to be safer. They offered to bring me with them, but I joked that I was holding down the fort for the United States. "What state are we in?" one of them asked, and I said, "Maine." They kissed me on the forehead in turn and dubbed me the Protector of Maine. After they left, I only used the generator intermittently, preferring to spend time in the dark, with candles. The former owner of the cottage had a closet full of them. One man, National Guard. When he first showed up at my doorstep, I assumed he was there to evacuate me, but it turned out he'd abandoned his post. I offered him a place to stay for the night, and he thanked me. I woke up with a knife to my throat and a hand on my breast. I told him I couldn't have sex with him, lying down like I was. He let me stand up, and I shoved him into the bookcase, knocking him unconscious. I dragged his body out to the beach and rolled it into the surf. He came to, sputtering sand. I pointed the knife at him and told him to walk and keep walking, and if he even looked back, I would end him. He obliged, and I watched him until he was a spot of darkness on the gray strip of shore, and then nothing. He was the last person I saw for a year. One woman, a religious leader, with a flock of 50 trailing behind her all dressed in white. For 3 days I made them wait around the edge of the property, and after I checked their eyes I permitted them to stay. They all camped around the cottage, on the lawn, on the beach. They had their own supplies and only needed a place to lay their heads, the leader said. She wore robes that made her look like a wizard. Night fell. She and I circled the camp in our bare feet, the light from the bonfire carving shadows into her face. We walked to the water's edge, and I pointed into the darkness, at the tiny island she could not see. She slipped her hand into mine. I made her a drink. "More or less moonshine," I said, as I handed her the tumbler, and we sat at the table. Outside I could hear people laughing, playing music, children romping in the surf. The woman seemed exhausted. She was younger than she looked, I realized, but her job was aging her. She sipped her drink, made a face at the taste. "We have been walking for so long," she said. "We stopped for a while somewhere near Pennsylvania, but the virus caught up with us when we crossed paths with another group. It took 12 before we got some distance between us and it." We kissed deeply for a long time, my heart hammering in my cunt. She tasted like smoke and honey. The group stayed for 4 days until she woke up from a dream and said she'd had an omen, and they needed to keep going. She asked me to come with them. I tried to imagine myself with her, her flock following behind us like children. I declined. She left a gift on my pillow, a pewter rabbit as big as my thumb. One man, no more than 20, floppy brown hair. He'd been on foot for a month. He looked like you'd expect. Skittish. No hope. When we had sex, he was reverent and too gentle. After we cleaned up, I fed him canned soup. He told me about how he walked through Chicago, actually through it, and how they had stopped bothering to dispose of the bodies after a while. He had to refill his glass before he talked about it further. "After that," he said, "I went around the cities." I asked him how far behind the virus was, really, and he said he did not know. "It's really quiet here," he said by way of changing the subject. "No traffic," I explained. "No tourists." He cried and cried, and I held him until he fell asleep. The next morning I woke up, and he was gone. One woman, much older than me, While she waited for the 3 days to pass, she meditated on a sand dune. When I checked her eyes, I noticed they were green as sea glass. Her hair grayed at the temples, and the way she laughed tripped pleasure down the stairs of my heart. We sat in the half-light of the bay window, and the buildup was so slow. She straddled me, and when she kissed me, the scene beyond the glass pinched and curved. We drank and walked the length of the beach, the damp sand making pale halos around our feet. She told about her once children, teenage injuries, having to put her cat to sleep the day after she moved to a new city. I told her about finding my mother, the perilous trek across Vermont and New Hampshire, how the tide was never still, my ex-wife.
"What happened?"
she asked. "It just didn't work," I said. I told her about the man in the empty house, the way he cried and the way his cum shimmered on his stomach, and how I could have scooped despair from the air by the handfuls. We remembered commercial jingles from our respective youths, including one for an Italian ice chain that I went to at the end of long summer days, where I ate gelato, drowsy in the heat. I couldn't remember the last time I'd smiled so much. She stayed. More refugees filtered through the cottage through us, the last stop before the border. And we fed them and played games with the little ones. We got careless. The day I woke up and the air had changed, I realized it had been a long time coming. She was sitting on the couch. She got up in the night and made some tea, but the cup was tipped, and the puddle was cold. And I recognized the symptoms from the television and newspapers, and then the leaflets, and then the radio broadcasts, and then the hushed voices around the bonfire. Her skin was the dark purple of compounded bruises, the whites of her eyes shot through with red, and blood leaking from the misty beds of her fingernails. There was no time to mourn. I checked my own face in the mirror, and my eyes were still clear. I consulted my emergency list and its supplies. I took my bag and tent, and I got into the dinghy and I rowed to the island, to this island, where I have been stashing food since I got to the cottage. I drank water and set up my tent, and began to make lists. Every teacher beginning with preschool, every job I've ever had, every home I've ever lived in, every person I've ever loved, every person who has probably loved me. Next week, I will be 30. The sand is blowing into my mouth, my hair, the center crevice of my notebook, and the sea is choppy and gray. Beyond it, I can see the cottage, a speck on the far shore. I keep thinking I can see the virus blooming on the horizon like a sunrise. I realize the world will continue to turn, even with no people on it. Maybe it will go a little faster. Mothers. Here she is, on the porch, all straw hair and slumpy joints, and a crack that passes through her lip like she is dirt that has never known rain. In her arms is a baby, genderless, red, not making any sort of noise. "Bad?" I say. She kisses the baby on the ear and then hands it to me. I flinch when she extends her arms, but take the infant just the same. Babies are heavier than you'd think. "She's yours," Bad says. I look down at the baby, who stares at me with wide eyes that shimmer like Japanese beetles. Her fingers curl around invisible locks of hair, and her sharp little nails dig into her skin. A feeling settles over me. A one-beer-deep feeling. A no-more-skittering-feet-after-the-trap-snaps feeling. I look back at Bad. "What do you mean, she's mine?" Bad looks at me as if I am unfathomably stupid, or possibly fucking with her, or both. "I was pregnant Now there's a baby. She's yours. My brain doubles back on the sentence. For months, my head has been so fuzzy. Mail is stacked unread on my kitchen table, and my clothes are a giant mound on my once immaculate floor. My uterus contracts in protest, confused. Look, Bad says, there's only so much that I can do. I can't do any more than that, right? I agree. But something feels wrong about following her down this line of reasoning, dangerous. You can only do as much as you can do, I repeat anyway. Good, Bad says. When the baby cries, she could be hungry, or thirsty, or angry, or cranky, or sick, or sleepy, or paranoid, or jealous, or she had planned something but it went horribly awry. So you'll need to take care of that, when it happens. I look down at the baby, who is not crying now. She blinks sleepily, and I find myself wondering if dinosaurs ever blinked in the same way, before they were incinerated into dust. The baby relaxes, putting even more weight into her body than I thought possible, and curls her head against my breasts. She even purses her lips a little, as if she thinks she might be able to nurse. I am not your mother, baby, I say. I can't feed you. I am so hypnotized by her that I miss the receding footsteps, the crack of the slamming car door. But then Bad is gone, and for once, I am not alone after. Back inside, I realize I don't even know the baby's name. On the floor is a small cloth bag that I don't remember receiving. I go into the kitchen where I sit down on a sagging cane chair. I imagine the chair breaking beneath me with the baby in my arms, and I stand back up and lean against the counter. Hello, baby, I say to the baby. Her lids swing open again, and she fixes my face in her gaze. Hello, baby. What's your name? The baby doesn't respond, but she also doesn't cry, which surprises me. I am a stranger. She has never seen me before. If she cries, it is to be expected. There are reasons. But what does it mean that she doesn't cry? Is she afraid? She doesn't look afraid. Perhaps babies are not capable of terror. She looks like she is working something out. She smells clean, but chemical. And behind it an edge of milk, bodily and sour, like something tipped askance. Her nose leaks a little, and she does not move to wipe it. There is a crash, a shrill wail. I jump. The baby has reached out her hand and caught a banana in the fruit bowl and taken down half a dozen pears. The hard pears roll, and the overripe ones splat. Now the baby does look terrified. She howls. I kiss the soft spot on her baby's skull and carry her into the next room. Shh, baby. Her mouth is an endless cavern into which light and thought and sound descend, never to return. Shh, baby. Why didn't Bad tell me her name? Shh, little thing, shh. My head throbs with the sound. Identical tears slide eye to ear on each side of her face, like a picture of a baby crying and not a baby at all. Shh, little thing, shh. A brisk breeze whisks through the dust outside, and the screen door slams open. I jump. She screams. When David and Ruth were married, they had a full Latin mass. Ruth's veil covered her face, and the hem bumped over the floor as she walked down the aisle. A sea of hats and veils covered up women's updos, as per the request of the couple. The service was beautiful and old, connecting them to millennia. At the reception, a woman in a cummerbund swept by me. I became very conscious of the way I chewed. I almost hadn't noticed her. In the crowd of relatives and friends, She'd registered as a very slight man, but no. Her high cheekbones and feminine way of crossing her feet on an invisible line that ran on the floor gave her away. I watched her as the party wore on, through the toasts, through the chicken dance, through Ruth's 12-year-old cousin doing a scandalous descent to the floor, butt first, upsetting her father. And when the dance floor cleared a bit, the woman stepped out beneath the white Christmas lights wrapped in muslin, popped out her collar, rolled up her starched sleeves, and began to dance. I'd always heard that weddings were supposed to make women horny, and for the first time, I understood. She moved with a flinty, masculine cool, such confidence, and I found myself unable to focus on anything else in the room. I got wet. I felt inadequate, too warm, inexplicably hungry. When she approached me, my heart slowed. She spun me around like a good swing partner, assured in control. I let myself go and laughed involuntarily. Gravity was gone. Later, we danced so slowly we might as well have been standing. She bent her head toward my ear. "You have the most beautiful hands I've ever seen," she said. I called her 2 days later, never having believed more firmly in love at first sight, in destiny. When she laughed on the other end of the line, something inside of me cracked open, and I let her step inside. This baby's head is bothering me because it's like a piece of fruit gone bad. I understand that now, in the middle of this endless desert of sound. It's like the soft spot on the peach that you can just plunge your thumb into with no questions asked, with not so much as a how do you do. I'm not going to, but I want to, and the urge is so serious that I put her down. She screams louder. I pick her up and lean her against me, whispering, "I love you, baby, and I am not going to hurt you." But the first thing is a lie, and the second thing might be a lie, but I'm just not sure. I should have the urge to protect her, but all I can think about is that soft spot, that place where I could hurt her if I tried, where I could hurt her if I wanted to. A month after we met, Bad was packing a glass bowl as she straddled me, poking the weed gently with her finger. When she tipped the lighter to it and inhaled, her body shuddered along an invisible curve, and the smoke crawled out of her mouth one limb at a time. An animal. "I haven't done this before," I told her. She handed me the pipe, cupped her hand around the bowl, and lit. I inhaled. Something flew into my windpipe, and I coughed so hard I was certain there'd be blood. "Let's try this," she said. She took a hit and put her mouth on mine, filling my lungs with heady smoke. I took it in, all of it, desire shooting straight through me. As we languished there, I felt my whole self loosening, my mind retreating to a place somewhere around my left ear. She showed me around her old neighborhood, and I was so high that I let her take my hand and guide me like a child. And then we were in the Brooklyn Museum, and there was a long table that never seemed to end, suggestive and flowering plates for the primordial goddess, for Virginia Woolf. We were somewhere in Little Russia, and then a drugstore, and then a beach. And all I could feel was her hand and the warm hug of sand around my feet. "I want to show you something," she said, and she walked me across the Brooklyn Bridge as the sun fell away. We took some days. We drove to Wisconsin to see the Jellyman, who, as it turned out, was dead. We turned and drove to the ocean, an island off the coast of Georgia. We drifted in water warm as soup. I held her, and in the levity of the water she held me. "The ocean," she said, "is a big les, I can tell. But not one of history, I said. No, she agreed.
Of space and time.
I considered this. My legs gently scissored through the water. My lips tasted like salt.
Yes,
I said. In the distance, gray humps rolled out of the sea. I imagined sharks and the mincemeat of our bodies.
Dolphins,
she breathed, and made it so. We sank. She was so much older than I was, but barely reminded me. She slid her hands high up my thighs in public places and told me her darkest story and asked about mine. I felt like she was seared into my timeline, unchangeable as Pompeii. She would shove me down onto the bed and hold herself upright with my pelvis. And I would let her be there, want her to be there, feel the weight of her, the clarity that settled over me. We'd peel off our clothes because they didn't belong between us. I would look over her smooth, pale skin, the pink shock of her labia, and kiss her mouth in a way that sent quakes straight to my fault lines, and think, thank God we cannot make a baby. Because she seized something inside of me that delivered me straight from her bed, from her mouth, from her cunt, and her angles and low voice, and dropped me into my first domestic fantasy, our first joint daydream. The Uptown Cafe on Kirkwood, wiping soft little gnocchi pieces from the gabbling chin of a baby, of our baby. We would joke and call her Mara, talk about her first words and her funny hair and her bad habits. Mara, a girl. Mara, our girl. Back in Bad's bed, in the good bed, she slid her hand into me, and I pulled and she gave, and I opened and she came without touching herself, and I responded by losing all speech. I thought, thank God we cannot make a baby. We can fuck senselessly and endlessly and come into each other. No condoms or pills or fear or negotiating days of the month or slumping against bathroom counters holding that stupid white stick up for inspection. Thank God we cannot make a baby. And when she said, come for me, come in me. Thank God we cannot make a baby. We made a baby. Here she is. We were in love, and I dreamt of our future. The home in the middle of the Indiana woods, an old chapel that once housed a cloister of nuns, nuns who prayed with their shoulders pressed against each other, and who took vows and called each other sister. A stone exterior. Dried mortar pinched and oozing. Narrow paths winding through old gardens. A new garden, where we have turned the earth and put things into it. Things that will grow, if we care for them. A large circle of stained glass, as tall as me, depicting a pouting, bleeding heart in slender slivers of smoky rose glass. Two of the panels cracked from age. Then a kitchen, with dark wood cabinets that open to reveal long-stemmed wine glasses, teak boxes full of cloudy silverware, a stove littered with 20-gallon pots and pans, a collection of 6 dozen mugs that we have found beautiful or ironic over the years, stacks of plates with chipped edges, a good set for company that we never have. Nearby, a small table with an empty wicker basket, an assortment of solid unpainted chairs, and catching the light from the window, a collection of glass jars, the labels peeled away, bands of glue rubbed off with a persistent finger, all with the intent of reuse. Beyond the table there is an altar, with candles lit for Billie Holiday and Willa Cather and Hypatia and Patsy Cline. Next to it, an old podium that once held a Bible, on which we have repurposed an old chemistry handbook as the Book of Lilith. In its pages is our own liturgical calendar. St. Clementine and All Wayfarers, Saints Lorena Hickok and Eleanor Roosevelt, observed in the summer with blueberries to symbolize the sapphire ring. The Vigil of St. Juliet, complete with mints and dark chocolate. Feast of the Poets, during which Mary Oliver is recited over beds of lettuce, Kay Ryan over a dish of vinegar and oil, Audre Lorde over cucumbers, Elizabeth Bishop over some carrots. The Exaltation of Patricia Highsmith, celebrated with escargot boiling in butter and garlic and cliffhangers recited by an autumn fire. The Ascension of Frida Kahlo, with self-portraits and costumes. The Presentation of Shirley Jackson, a winter holiday started at dawn and ended at dusk, with a gambling game played with lost milk teeth and stones, some of them with their own books. The Major and Minor Arcana of Our Little Religion. In the fridge, pickled cucumbers and green beans crowding ridged jars, two glass containers of milk, one good, one sour, a carton of half and half, birth control from the age of men that I still haven't thrown away, a near black eggplant, a jar of horseradish the shape of a bar of soap, olives, sweet Italian peppers tense as hearts, soy sauce, bloody steaks hidden away in the dry fold of paper, leaking shamefully, a cheese drawer with balls of fresh mozzarella floating in their own milky water broth, and salami with a dusty white tubing that smells, bad swears, like semen, rotting leeks that will be added to the compost pile, candied onions, shallots the size of fists. In their freezer, cracked plastic ice trays with cubes swollen past their banks, pesto made from the basil plants in the garden, cookie dough that will be eaten raw despite health warnings. The cupboards, when opened, are cluttered with extra virgin olive oil, half a dozen bottles, some full of forests of rosemary and fat bulbs of peeled garlic. Sesame oil, whose glass bottle never seems to lose the greasy sheen on its outside, no matter how many times it is wiped clean. Coconut oil, half a waxy white solid, half like plasma. Cans of black-eyed peas and cream of mushroom soup. Boxes of almonds. A small sack of raw organic pine nuts. Stale oyster crackers. Eggs on the counter. Brown and pale green and speckled and irregular in size. One of them has gone bad, but you can't tell from the outside. You'll only figure it out if you put it in a glass of water and it floats like a witch. In the bedroom there is a queen-size bed, a raft in the middle of a great stone ocean. On the dresser rolls a light bulb that, if held close to the ear and agitated, would reveal the broken filament rattling in the glass. Necklaces rope old wine bottles like nooses. Frosted stoppers silence glass decanters. A nightstand that, when opened, reveals, "Shut that, please." In the bathroom, a mirror flecked with mascara, from when Bad leans in close, the amoeba of her breath growing and shrinking. "You never live with a woman. You live inside of her," I overheard my father say to my brother once. And it was indeed as if, when peering into the mirror, you were blinking out through her thickly fringed eyes. And outside the door, nature, the spinning, breathtaking cathedral of the sky arches above the trees, trees that bend lush and neon green in spring, all buds, then bloom. Sudden rain breaks the tender leaves from their stems and lays the floor thick with a bright carpet. In the tangle of branches, baby birds, the gray and pink of half-cooked shrimp and with bones like dried spaghetti, scream for their mothers. Then the hazy buzz of summer saunters in, and the air screeches and hums. Cicada-killing wasps catch the weakest and stab them motionless, hauling the weight of their bodies and their glass wings up, and somewhere else. Fireflies drunkenly dazzle the dark. The leaves are full, dark green, the trees dense and folded in on themselves, catching secrets. And only the violent tear of thunder and the bleach burn of lightning can pull the grove apart.
And then autumn. The first autumn, our first autumn. The first squash dish. The sweaters. The burning smell of the space heater. Never leaving the heavy blankets. The scent of smoke that reminds me of being a Girl Scout and being 12 and camping with girls who hate me. The leaves catch fire, color burning away green like a disease. More rain. Another carpet of leaves, yellow as dandelions, red as pomegranate skin, orange as carrot peels. There are strange evenings when the sun sets, but it rains anyway, and the sky is gold and peach and also gray and purple like a bruise. Every morning, a fine mist coats the grove. Some nights, a bloody harvest moon rises over the horizon and stains the clouds like an alien sunrise. And then the dry and curl, the slow approach of death on trillions of radial feet. Peristalsis, perfect winter beast. The ground more exposed than we thought possible. The trees alone. The howl groan of the wind, the smell of the coming of snow. Blizzard throughout the night, illuminated by nothing out here in the woods and in the darkness. Except for a flashlight beam from the other side of the window, which catches the fat flakes descending before they vanish beyond its reach. Inside, parched and itchy skin, cool ocean whirled onto backs. Fucking. Muffling the cries, holding each other in a pocket of warmth beneath the quilts. And in the morning, we shove open the door, two bodies wrapped and huffing to free themselves into a world where they do not want to go. Snowdrifts turning the nuances of nature into bumps, reminding us to keep perspective, reminding us that everything has a season, reminding us that time passes and so will we. One day. And at the edge of the clearing, mittens turn our Mara's tiny hands into cartoons. Her puffy jacket is zipped up to her small nose, and a woolen hat protects her fine brown hair. Then we are reminded that we are alive. We love each other all of the time, and like each other most of the time, and that women can turn children into this world like breathing. Mara reaches out and up, not for us, but for some unseen presence, a voice, the shadow of a once nun, unghosts of a future civilization that will populate this forest with a city long after we are dead. Mara reaches up, and we walk over to her and take her hand. Our baby cries. I hold her up to me. She is too small for food, I think. Too small for... Balancing her on my hip, I tear through my half-empty fridge, shoving aside Tupperware with velvety leftovers, a can wrapped in tinfoil. I find a jar of applesauce, but none of my spoons are small enough for her mouth. I dip my finger in the applesauce and offer it to her. She sucks hard. I rest my hand against the crown of her skull. Kiss her skin, delicate with baby oil. She snuffles and sobs, bits of applesauce bubbling out of her mouth. Egg? I ask her. She sneezes. Apple? Dog? Girl? Boy? The baby does not look like me. And bad? My pointy nose and brown hair, my sulky pout, her round chin and detached earlobes. That open, howling mouth. That's all bad. I stop, the danger of this joke still firing in my brain, even as I realize that bad isn't here to hear it, to pause whatever she is doing to raise an eyebrow at me. Maybe scold me for saying such a thing in front of our daughter, or maybe throw a glass at my head. I pull my phone out of my pocket with my free hand and dial. Bad's voice echoes mechanically on the other end and carves new spaces into me. Beep. I leave a message. What I say. Why did you leave her with me? What I want to say. This almost broke me, but it didn't. It made me stronger than before. You have made me better. Thank you. I will love you until the end of time. I wanted too much from her, I think. I demanded too much. I love you, I murmured while asleep, while awake, into her hair, into her neck. Please don't call me that, I reminded her. I would never talk like that to you. I only want you, I swear, I said, and paranoia crept into her voice like an infection. I believe in a world where impossible things happen, where love can outstrip brutality, can neutralize it, as though it never was, or transform it into something new and more beautiful. Where love can outdo nature. The baby nurses. I don't know on what, but she suckles just the same. Her gums catch, and it hurts. But I don't want her to stop, because I am her mother and she needs what she needs, even if it's not a true thing. She bites, and I cry out, but she is so small and I cannot put her down. Mara, I whisper. She looks at me, directly at me, as if she recognized her name. I press my lips to her forehead and rock her back and forth, quietly gasping for air. She is real. She is real. She is solid in my arms. She smells clean and new. No mistakes. She is not yet a girl or a monster or anything. She is just a baby. She is ours. I make Mara a crib by shoving my bed into a corner. I build walls with small embroidered pillows. I lay her down. She starts to scream again. It comes from nowhere and goes on, endless and even as the horizon at sea. It doesn't taper. She doesn't inhale for breathing. Her flailing hands catch my face, cut it a little. I lay her down on the bed. Mara, I say, Mara, please, please don't. And she doesn't stop. It goes on and on. For hours I bounce next to her on the bed, and the howling has filled the room, and I cannot unhear it. And the clean smell of baby is replaced by something red-hot, like the burner of an electric stove with nothing on it. I touch her little feet, and she screams. And I blow raspberries on her belly, and she screams. And something inside of me is breaking. I am a continent, but I will not hold. A teacher overheard Bad screaming at me on the phone from the next bathroom stall. I knew she was there. I saw her high-heeled feet splayed on the tile. I heard her take in a breath as Bad's voice dropped low and cold and leaked through the receiver like gas. She waited until I was gone to leave. She awkwardly addressed it in the hallway that afternoon, her hands twisting around the cap of a ballpoint pen. I guess, she said. All I'm saying is that it's just not normal. I'm just worried for you. You are so kind to reach out, I said. I'm just saying that if it always sounds like that, then even if you think something is there, nothing is there. She accidentally flipped the cap out of her hands and it went skittering down the long hallway. Let me know if you want me to call someone. Okay? I nodded, and she walked away. Even as she vanished around the corner, I was still nodding. Mara pauses for breath. So much time has passed that light streaks the sky outside of the window. She takes me in again, my whole self, into her eyes, all of my shame and pain and the truth of her mother's. The honest truth of them. I feel a jolt, my secret slipping from me unwilling. Then the screaming begins again, but I can endure it because of that precious moment, that break. My tolerance is fresh again, my love renewed. If she gives me one of those every day or so, I should be fine. I can do this. I can be a good mother. I brush my finger along her curls and sing her a song from my childhood. Bill Grogan's goat was feeling fine.